even in South Yorkshire or posh Yorkshire like York, they wouldn't have heard of Lurkin. When I first started writing the book, people would say, and I won't say specifically who, but I was given the feedback, take the dialect out. It won't get a publishing deal with dialect in it. You've got to make people speak with received pronunciation for the big five to even consider it. And that's not been my experience at all. Originally, when I submitted the book, it had a glossary of terms in it. That glossary included the definition of lurkin and spice for sweets. But my publisher actually said, I want to take all of that out. I think readers are intelligent enough to either look it up or work it out. And I was really thrilled that they felt that way. Those little observations for me are probably the most important bit of the writing process. Just the memories of the things people used to talk about.
Welcome to Bestsellers. I'm Natalie Jameson.
I'm Phil Williams, and I'm so excited about today's episode because it's one of those beautiful moments that happen. Actually, we've got to say, we're quite lucky. These moments happen quite a lot between us, don't they? You'll always come to me and go, oh, they've got this amazing book, you've got to read it. Or I'll
Yeah.
come to you and go, and you know, 9 times out of 10, the other likes the book that the first person
Yes.
suggested. And this was a book that a couple of people said to me, you're not ready, you've got to read this, you've got to read this. And then so I did my 30-page test, then bought the book immediately and finished the book, and then said to Natalie, we've got to do this book and try and track this author down. So it's completely homegrown, today's guest. It's Jenny Godfrey. It's a debut. It's The List of Suspicious Things. And it's just wonderful now, isn't it, this book?
Yeah, it's such a delight, and I'm so pleased because she's having such phenomenal success. The book's only been out for less than 2 months, 5 weeks, I think, 5, 6 weeks, and it's doing incredibly well. And yeah, we got to spend an hour in Jenny's company and hope that you enjoy getting to know her as much as we did. So here is Phil with your intro.
Our guest on Bestsellers today is a woman who's brought us a debut novel that's so good I couldn't believe it's a debut novel. I can't look at you when I do this introduction because it's too glowing. How did I come across this? Someone, I think two separate people who don't know each other on other sides of the world said to me, have you read The List of Suspicious Things yet by Jenny Godfrey? And I said, no, but I keep seeing it in Waterstones. So I did my 30-page test and then I bought the book and devoured the rest really, really, really quickly. I would say, and I've said this to John, to Jenny as well, and Johnny, although he didn't care. I would say that it is the best debut I've read since Girl on a Train, and we get sent a lot of debuts, and this is the best debut since that book, in my view, and it's easily my book of 2024. And I realise we're only 4 months into the year, but it is easily that good. So no pressure on you, Jenny Godfrey. Welcome to
Thank you so much. I now
Bestsellers.
feel like, I mean, can we just end the podcast there? Just with that glowing review. That's all anyone needs to know about the whole thing.
But this can't be news to you because the reviews across the board have been glowing for this. And how many weeks are you in the Sunday Times top 10 chart now? Because I know you keep track on your own Instagram.
I do. So it's 5 weeks, and at some point this afternoon, I'll get a call to tell me whether it's 6 weeks.
Well, and it should be. And it should. It, I think the odds of plummeting all the way down below 10 is quite slim, aren't they, in 1 week?
Well, not
You'd have to have pulped all your copies, wouldn't you?
not in this current market. Often, particularly debuts, go in and then out in a week. It's much more common to do that. So every week for me is a massive bonus, and I celebrate fully every single week I'm in there.
Right, Jenny, just bear with me a minute while I just consult with my colleague. Natalie, you're a woman. What's a polite way for me to ask Jenny how old she is and why it's taken so long to write a debut novel? How do I do that politely without offending her?
It's written. It won't offend me.
I think you just say like, what brought you to writing at this time?
Excellent, excellent. That, Jenny, what brought you to writing at this stage in your life?
I said at this time, not at this stage in your life. Are you not listening?
Typical man.
It's totally fine. I'm very open about my age. So, I started writing at aged 49. having wanted to be a writer as a kid, if you'd asked me what I wanted to be when I was 7 or 8, I would have said an authoress like Enid Blyton, who I know isn't cool anymore, but when I was growing up, she was the coolest. And so I wanted to be an author as a kid, but life got in the way. You know, it just didn't seem something that it would be possible for somebody like me to do. And I went off and did a corporate job for a really long time. And
so, can I just clarify, because this is a big issue for us in the podcast, somebody like me, what do you mean by that? How do you define that?
Well, I mean, I come from a very similar background to Miv in the book, which is a working class Yorkshire family. Most of my family worked in the mills, and I'm first generation to go to university.
Same.
Yeah. And writer didn't feel to me like something it was possible for me to do.
Which is a shame, isn't it? And it's something that we try and tackle a lot on bestsellers.
Yeah.
Because we both feel, don't we, that strongly, that somehow impinges into the selection of books that we're offered and also who's targeted to buy them.
Yeah, well, I also think there's such a kind of, it's the gatekeepers as well, right, about what stories people might want to read. And I mean, I'm always fascinated by the, I hate to gender stuff too much, but just in terms of, I find confidence is such a thorny issue and particularly affects women more than it does men in terms of, you know, if you haven't got that inner confidence to just think, well, why not? Why don't I do it? Then you just talk yourself out of it before you even get to that point. So yeah, I'm very pleased that you have written this book, Jenny.
Well, funnily enough, you should mention confidence. I reckon there's something about being in midlife that makes that easier. Are you allowed to swear on this podcast?
Yeah, say what you fucking want.
Great. So essentially, at age 49, I pressed the fuck it button, having had a total midlife crisis, thinking, I don't want to do this for the rest of my life. I am so unhappy doing this corporate job, 9 to 5, well, 8 to 8. And I pressed the fuck it button, left my job without anything to go to, which everyone tells you, you must not do. However, I did. And I decided that I was going to write a book while I worked out what I was going to do next. And that's now nearly 5 years ago. So you can do your maths, Phil. I'm in my 50s.
Did you have some cash put aside?
I did have. So I took voluntary redundancy. So I had enough money to see me through the writing process. If it hadn't sold, I would have had to go back to working probably in a corporate job. But I also work part-time in Waterstones. I just basically decided to build a life around books because that's what I'm most passionate about.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And so you almost manifested it.
Yeah. People say that to me, and I sort of did. Yeah. And I also think that the universe gives you clues about what you're supposed to be doing. And it gave me some thumping great big clues along the way that this was what I was supposed to be doing. So it's a bit of both.
Yeah. I mean, and I think it's fascinating just talking about that at the start of the podcast as well, because you're obviously talking about it very confidently now, but I imagine whilst you were doing that, you were probably shitting yourself.
Right. So thank you for saying that, because you're absolutely right. I can talk about it now like it was, oh, you know, then this happened, and it sounds like a great story. At the time, I had so many sleepless nights and so many tearful conversations with friends about, have I gone mad? Am I honestly insane? And I used to read, I'm really active on social media, and I used to read all the things on writing Twitter about how difficult it is to get published. I mean, how difficult it is to get an agent, let alone get published. And I would think, what, you know, what have I done? I must have had a complete midlife moment. But I don't know, I'm one of those people, I have to, if I'm going to do something, I have to do it 100%. One of my favourite phrases is, I recognise balance when I swing past it. So the book was never going to get written unless I gave myself to it 100%. Not everyone is like that. I am.
And then, how difficult was it to get published?
Oh, you see. So I always say to anyone who's an aspiring author, half listen to me and half don't, because at least I'm proof it happens. But at the same time, I don't think it's the standard way that it happens. So my agent found me via an anthology after a course I'd done. So my agent is Nell Andrew, who's very well known in the industry. She read an extract of The List of Suspicious Things, emailed me to say, can I read the rest? Read it overnight and offered me representation.
Yeah, that doesn't happen, does it? Because Natalie's represented by Darley Anderson. How did that happen for you, Nat? Did you have to send off a manuscript?
I did, yeah. So I did that. It's probably no bad thing actually to compare and contrast our fortunes at this point, and then we can reconfigure once I've reached your lofty levels. Jenny. But similarly, I did a writing course and there was an anthology that was published, and there were people who were contacted by agents after that anthology. I was not. So I did the traditional, finish my first book, sent out, you know, the first 10,000 words, chapters, whatever it was that you had to, did my research, you had to send different things to different agents. I tried to target ones I thought might suit my writing style and suit me. And yeah, my agent, Tanara Simons, was the first one that bit, really. And I had like quite a lot of people going, yeah, I want to read your manuscript. And then she was the first one that offered me representation. I was like, well, great. And she was so enthusiastic. And there was quite a lot of people going, yeah, I really like your writing, let me get back to you like next week. And Tanara was like, I've just stayed up all night reading it. Yeah, I want to represent you. So I was like, okay, I'm going to go with you. So, but then we kind of worked on that book and then it didn't sell. So I'm in that state where I'm still writing the long gestating second book and still trying to pick up my confidence, I think, a bit from not having that first one sell, which again, I think is the norm. And, you know, you read all these stories, right, about authors who take 10 books before a publisher, you know, bites. And I'm like, oh my word, I'm not sure if I can wait that long, but I'm going to give it my best shot.
And isn't it all about the tenacity and the persistence to keep going? I'm absolutely convinced of that. And I think your story is the norm. It really is. And now I don't want to tell my submissions.
No, we do want to hear it, don't we? We do want to hear it.
Yeah, this is just like personal torture for me. Don't worry about me, Jenny. I'm fine.
So your agent comes after you. You get signed. And once you've delivered the book.
So, we took a good year to edit it. So, right. You know, there was definitely some real proper writing graft that went on. And Nell decided to send it out one Monday morning. We'd got it all planned. And then just before, she changed her mind and said, I'm going to send it on the Thursday so the editors have the weekend to read the book. And because I knew from everything I'd read that I'd be waiting at least a week, if not two, for any kind of response on the book, I didn't read the email saying who it had gone to and exactly when it had gone, and was merrily driving home that day when Nell called me and said, are you driving? In a kind of slightly high-pitched voice, which Nell never uses. And I said, yeah. She said, could you pull over? And I mean, I can't remember, it was 6 or 8 hours after the book had gone on submission, we had our first offer. And it was from a major publisher. And from that moment to about 24 hours later was mainly me wide-eyed discussing numbers, contracts, plans with various different imprints of Penguin before everything was signed 24 hours later.
Wow. That must have been just like, I mean, I'm genuinely so pleased for you. I loved reading this book so much and you totally deserve all of that. But I can also imagine that was probably quite frightening as well, because you're wondering if you're making the right choices.
Yeah. And especially because I wasn't, normally I'm quite a planned and ordered person. I kind of think about things quite carefully. In this situation, it was so unexpected. I was blindsided by it. And I made part of the decision on instinct. Thankfully, that instinct was really sound. Basically, the publisher I went with is Venetia Butterfield, who is actually the managing director of a number of Penguin imprints, including Hutch Heinemann, which I'm published on.
Sounds like a lovely place to go for a weekend break, doesn't it?
Venetia
Butterfield. Where are you off to this week? I'm off to Venetia Butterfield. Oh, it's beautiful. You'll love it there.
So true. And before I spoke to her on the phone, she sent me a text, and that text basically said, look, I really want to publish your book, so I'm going to be as nervous as you, but I just want you to know that my dad smelled a Swarfiga when I was a child. Now, that's very early on in the book, about Miv's dad smelling of Swarfiga, and something about that little detail, I just knew it was her. I just knew I was going to end up going with her, and I did. She's incredible. But just on that text, that was my instinct that she was the right person.
But I think that kind of says so much about you as a person, but also your writing too, which I don't want to speak for you, but I imagine the joy that you get from reading and writing is connecting with people. So if you hear from somebody who has like an empathetic connection with something that you've written, and it can be the tiniest thing, you're like, yeah, you're part of my tribe.
100%. And she's proved to be exactly that ever since. And in the acknowledgements, it does actually say, you had me at Swarfiga, because she really did.
I love that.
And we should probably set this book up. Now that we've got discovered how you got to write it. Do you want to have a go at it? I'm happy to have a go, but I don't want to do spoilers. And I think it's one of those books where you really benefit from. I knew nothing when I opened it.
Yes. And a lot of people say that, because it's actually very difficult to hand it to somebody and tell them what it's about. So I will give it a go, just because I've had the benefit of having to do this quite a few times. So The List of Suspicious Things is set in 1970s West Yorkshire, and it's the story of 12-year-old Miv, whose home life isn't the best. Money is tight, and her mum is ill in a way she can't possibly understand. Margaret Thatcher has just become Prime Minister, and there's an undercurrent of fear in the area caused by the murders of women that have been taking place since 1975. And because of all of this, Miv's dad decides he's going to move the family down south, which to any northerner is a fate worse than death. And Miv decides that she is going to make Yorkshire safe again and catch the murderer known then as the Yorkshire Ripper. And so she recruits her best friend, Sharon. The two of them compile a list of all the things in their neighbourhood that they see that are suspicious, and they investigate them one by one. And in doing so, they uncover all the secrets of their community, but they also find the power of connection.
Brilliantly done.
Thank you so much.
Brilliantly done. I'll tell you why it's so brilliantly done, because one of the things I've been saying to people as I've been recommending your book is this is not a book about the Yorkshire Ripper. The Yorkshire Ripper is the spectre that is kind of in the background of the book, but don't be thinking, oh, I don't want to read about mass murder, because it's not a mass murder book. That's not what this is. And I think it's really important people grasp that, because otherwise you miss all of the beautifully nuanced friendships that are in the book that brought me so much joy, and I'm sure you as well, Nat. Mm-hmm. And I think because we're all of a similar vintage, the kind of, you mentioned 79, you mentioned Thatcher coming to power. I was at primary school when Thatcher Milk Snatcher was being sung, because our milk was taken from us at kind of 6, 7, 8 maybe. And so all that stuff is in the book, and the games that they play and mentions of Operation and stuff like that's all part of my era.
Yeah.
Which helps to create then this familiarity for the reader.
Yeah.
How important was it for you to make sure that it didn't get put on the crime shelf as a Yorkshire Ripper book?
Sometimes it is, by the way. I've heard it described as so many different genres. It's actually caused me much amusement. But this isn't a book about the Yorkshire Ripper. It is a book about Yorkshire. And you can't write a book about Yorkshire in the 1970s without taking him into account, because he was, as you've called him, a spectre that kind of haunted our childhoods. But the book is much more a celebration of all the best aspects of Yorkshire and community and family and difference. So yeah, it was really important to me that that's where the attention was. And I know often the press will pick up on the Yorkshire Ripper element, but what I hope and what seems to be happening is people give it a go anyway and discover the richer nature of the book.
Yeah, I think for sure. I'm intrigued as well because we are of similar eras. Phil, what was your Swarfiga moment? Did you have like a, was there a phrase that kind of, or a something that was mentioned? Was it operation or was it something else?
Cricket for me. Hmm. Yeah, it was the cricket and the fact that the I don't want to give too much away, but that cricket becomes a thing amongst the group of friends, shall we say?
Yeah.
And that was very much part of my childhood. You know, I remember Dad taking us to Edgbaston. So we grew up in Birmingham. And we went to Edgbaston and we would take a bat and ball. And because cricket's all day and it's quite long, you'd watch a bit of the Britannic County Assurance or whatever it was that you'd gone to see. And then you'd go to the back of the stand and play a bit. And then you'd go back in and watch a few more. And that, yeah, so that was the Swarfiga moment, that definitely.
Yeah, so for me, I mean, there were lots of things. There were the mention of Jackie photo shoots in annuals, which I think I came to a bit later and kind of remember getting lots of those from car boot sales and stuff and going, what's this? That's so funny. But also the mention of Miv having a weekly hair wash. And then after the weekly hair wash, you're allowed to like sit by the electric fire and get a little bit warmer or like frazzle.
Yeah.
Yeah, I used to have like me and my sister would have the weekly bath. Which like sounds so archaic now, right? We did.
So
and we had mum, and in fact I've said that another friend of mine who was grew up in Wales had this. So this was clearly a national thing that we allowed Mr. Matey, right?
Yes.
But mum would say, hey, it's once a week stuff, that is.
Otherwise it'd be fairy liquid or just generic washing up liquid. Yeah.
That's so funny. And I also really like the mention of Matchstick Men and Matchstick Cats and Dogs, which was coincidentally the very first vinyl single that I ever obviously asked my parents to buy, because I was 4 years old when that came out. And what I did was I obviously couldn't read or write at that time, but we've still got the vinyl single where I've drawn Matchstick Men and Cats and Dogs really badly onto the vinyl, like the inner circle bit that you could actually write on, which obviously you're not supposed to write on records, but I did that. So I was like, it's mine. I'm drawing my matchstick cats and not age four. Oh yeah.
I think that's really cool though. My first bought vinyl was Shawaddy Waddy, which I am really ashamed of. So I think Match.Men, Match.Cats and Dogs, much cooler.
I don't know. can I ask you a bit about some of the Yorkshire stuff in it? Because sorry for my sins, I was born in Oxford. Nothing I can do about that. Grew up down south. And I knew like some of the phrases like that I think are kind of universal, like butty for sandwiches or sarnies and stuff and things. But I had not heard of, I'm going to say this wrong now. How do you say like hanging out, like playing?
Lurking out. Lurking.
Yeah, now to be fair, I hadn't either, though. That was new to me.
No, it's a very, I mean, this is really specific dialect to Dewsbury, Batley, Hepmondwike, even in South Yorkshire or posh Yorkshire like York, they wouldn't have heard of lurking. And it's really funny because a couple of things to say about that. First is when I first started writing the book and started having people who might have a view on it read it, people would say, and I won't say specifically who, but I was given the feedback, take the dialect out. It won't get a publishing deal with dialect in it. You've got to make people speak with received pronunciation for the big five to even consider it. And that's not been my experience at all. Not once have I been asked to change any aspect of the dialect. And
that's
I find
good.
That really interesting that early potential gatekeepers, certainly not my agent either, but early potential gatekeepers did give me the feedback to take the dialect out.
I mean, surely the obvious pushback on that is Irvine Welsh, isn't it?
Yes,
if you've read much
what?
Irving Welsh, but
it
that's
would have been.
In,
but I actually went for Kestrel for a Knave,
right,
which was one of my early inspirations. But also, I just felt really strongly that why would I bother setting the book in Yorkshire if I'm going to have
people going, hello, good morning.
Exactly.
Have you discovered the murderer yet? No.
Yes, exactly. And I originally, when I submitted the book, it had a glossary of terms in it. That glossary included the definition of lurking and spice for sweets. But my publisher actually said, I want to take all of that out. I think readers are intelligent enough to either look it up or work it out. And I was really thrilled that they felt that way.
I'll tell you what annoys me about this in particular. And Imran Mahmood was on last week, and if you heard that, Jenny, but
that
he was saying the same thing about getting a US publishing deal, because his fourth book is his first to get a distinctive US publishing deal. But what annoys me now is we get all of the American culture imported, and no one's, we're not, you know, the Wire, for example, you know, none of us were fluent in Baltimore cop speak until that came out. You know what I mean? And yet all of a sudden, you know, what was, can you remember what Imran was told to take out that wouldn't go down well with the US audience?
Was it
a place setting?
I can remember there was something that he told us that is a spoiler that we didn't want to talk about that was taken out by US publishers.
Yeah.
But I think it's kind of, it's a really, I mean, it's just such a shame, right? Because it means that then reading and writing just becomes homogenized, and nobody wants that. Like, the whole point is that it opens you up to different cultures and experiences, and it's such an odd thing. But I don't know why.
Well, interestingly, The List of Suspicious Things doesn't have a US publishing deal yet on that basis.
Is it purely on that basis?
Well,
that's what you've
the feedback, the feedback has been, it's just too northern. So, you know, let's see whether that changes now that it's been in bestseller lists for however long.
Yeah.
And has Barack picked it up yet? Because he listens to our podcast, doesn't he? He often,
no, he doesn't.
Whenever does Barack Obama does his summer reads, it's always the books we've done.
Oh,
isn't it?
Well, I mean, there you go.
I've not contacted lawyers. I'm not petty. Do you know what I mean? But
I've no doubt he will pick it up.
That's what
it
needs. And it needs, or a Reese Witherspoon.
It does need,
you know,
a Reese.
And then all of a sudden it'll get made into a movie. And then you know what? Yorkshire tourism will boom and it'll be all down to you. And you'd have broken that glass ceiling with hammer.
Oh my gosh, I'm loving this imagined future. Thank you.
I find that really saddening though, otherwise, because then it means that you can't write a book set in Manchester or in kind of Glasgow, or do you know what I mean? It just always has to be, as you said, that's a brilliant word, isn't that, homogenised.
Yeah, but I think it's a wider discussion, I think, culturally too, because I know that with the streaming platforms, so the way that people consume TV shows now, there's been a whole kickback because for a lot of those platforms, again, it was thought it had to be this sort of almost like not utopian setting, but just such a sort of universal setting that removes any kind of local, certainly like in whatever country it's created in, it has to basically sell around the world. So they think that they just have to make it in this sort of standardized setting that could be, I mean, it's probably America, right? That's sort of what they're taking as the universality of it. But yeah, I think it's a really dangerous route to go down. And I think there's been quite a lot of kickback, certainly in the TV world, for that. So hopefully it's just a blip and it won't happen in books.
Yeah, and I mean, I am thrilled for lots of very personal reasons that The List of Suspicious Things has been a bestseller. But I'm also thrilled for that reason. And funnily enough, I've just, the last episode of yours I listened to was with Millie Johnson. And I enjoyed it immensely. And on my last tweet saying, we've made another week, she commented, do it for Yorkshire. And there is a real sense of, there's a proper Yorkshire book on the bestseller list, and that makes me really happy.
Shall we hear a bit then?
Yeah.
Can.
And give people a flavour of it. We've been talking about it for a while, and I feel like we've teased you for too long. So we're going to probably start at the beginning, aren't we? So there's no spoilers whatsoever.
I will indeed start at the beginning. So chapter one, Miv. It would be easy to say that it all started with the murders. But actually, it began when Margaret Thatcher became Prime Minister. A woman in charge at country just isn't right. They're not made for it, my Auntie Jean said on the day the election results were announced. As if the last lot weren't bad enough. She's the beginning of the end for Yorkshire, and I'll tell you why and all. She was bustling about our small kitchen, vigorously rewiping surfaces I had already wiped. I was sat at the table in my brown and orange school uniform, shelling peas into a colander on the chipped yellow formica top, popping fresh ones into my mouth whenever she wasn't looking. I wanted to point out that, like Margaret Thatcher, Auntie Jean was also a woman. But Auntie Jean hated being interrupted mid-flow, and it was just the two of us, meaning there was no escape from her opinions, of which there were many. So many, she began to list them. Number one, she said, her wiry grey curls bobbing along as she shook her head. You take one look at that face and you can see what power does to a woman. It hardens them. You can tell she's no heart, can't you? She took a wooden spoon off the draining board and wagged it at me for emphasis. I mumbled. For a moment, I considered just nodding occasionally while secretly reading the book I had open, a corner tucked under the colander to keep it flat. But though Auntie Jean's hearing was less than sharp, her other senses were razor-like, and she would have smelled my inattention like a hunting dog. Number two, she's already taken milk away from poor children's mouths and jobs away from the hands of hard-working men. I knew at least part of this was true. The rhyme, Thatcher, Thatcher, Milk Snatcher, was still heard in our school, years after she'd taken away the little bottles of disgusting lukewarm milk we used to have to drink daily there. Three, these bloody murders every 5 minutes. That's what Yorkshire's famous for now. Dead girls.
Lovely. I should have checked beforehand. Have you done your own audiobook? Because you should have done.
I didn't do my own audiobook. But I have to say, the audiobook is incredible. It's Joanne Froggatt.
Oh, yeah.
Nice.
And in fact, it's not just Joanne Froggatt. It has got five voices for each of the points of view. So it's got Joanne Froggatt, Gemma Whelan, Martin Noble, Asif Khan, and Simon Harvey.
And that's important as well, that we'll talk about the points of view in a moment. I wanted to mention one of the characters that you reference in that reading, Auntie Jean, because Auntie Jean is just, she holds the family together. She's the matriarch of this book. And in one of Miv's chapters, I will offer no context to this so we don't do any spoilers. Miv says, and I won't try and do the accent because it will sound insulting if I try and do it. You can do it after. It's as hot as 1976, I said, in an impression of Auntie Jean that made Sharon laugh out loud and reply, there's warm and there's warm. Every grown-up we knew referred to the summer of 76 as the barometer of all hot weather and would discuss it endlessly. It was a running joke between us. This is another of my mum's references.
Yes.
And she's not from Yorkshire. But everything went back to that summer. You, there was you. We didn't have your brother then. It was just you running around in your pants. Like that really made me laugh. Those observations have really crystallised for me, not just the era, but also the socioeconomic setting for the book as well.
Yes. And those little observations for me are probably the most important bit of the writing process. Just the memories of the things people used to talk about that really place the book, even more than kind of products or food or games. It's those observations that for me were a delight to remember and uncover.
Can I do one more? Do you mind just to sneak one more?
I don't mind.
So this is where Miv and Sharon get to go to Ishtiak's place where they're hanging out, and Ishtiak's dad runs the corner shop. This is what you need to know about this. It was full of contradictions. The television sat on wooden packing boxes with the names of fruit and veg printed on the sides, and the brown settee was worn and threadbare at the seams. But piled high in a dark corner were Ishtiak's cricket equipment and teetering towers of the very latest games and books, their primary colours shining out against the dull and dingy walls and floor. And in one paragraph, you've said to me, they haven't got much money, but this kid's dad makes sure that what he loves, he's got plenty of. And I just thought, how brilliantly done.
Thank you. Thank you.
And that they played Kaplunk, which was a favourite of mine too.
Yeah.
Massive favourite of mine. Big time.
Do you know why it wasn't of mine? Because it took ages to set up, or I thought it was ages. You had to get all the marbles in, all the sticks in, before you could even play. I'm like, oh.
But also, I'm kind of intrigued. I mean, I don't know how... what sort of feedback you've had from readers, because again, as we've said, we're similar ages, so these references, they just hit automatically. But I think because you do describe them so well, and as Phil was just saying with that passage, you get the sentiment around it and why it serves a purpose in the story. Have you had younger readers get in touch?
Yes, I have been I've been really surprised by two things. One being how much younger readers seem to love the book. When I was going around to bookshops giving out early copies, I just really remember in Bournemouth, this lovely young bookseller picking up the book, reading the back and going, Margaret Thatcher, it's historical fiction. And me thinking, it's not historical fiction. The 1970s were yesterday. But seen through that lens, actually the book is historical fiction, which that seems to really resonate. And the second thing I've been really surprised about is how many men love the book. For some reason, I had it in my head that this would be the kind of book that women would love. And I've been astonished by just how many men not only have read it, but have really fallen in love with it.
That's great.
Why are you surprised by that?
I don't know, mate. I think it's actually some of my own internal prejudice, thinking that I'm a woman, therefore women will read my book. And if I think about it properly, the book is not a gendered book at all. But that's been a surprise for me, and one that's actually smashed a few of my own prejudices.
Because one of the things I've loved about it as a man is that you kind of educated us, even through the historical fiction lens, about how the Ripper murders were reported at the time. And I was too young, obviously, to be in journalism then. But some of the guys I worked with, when I did North of England for Radio 1 in 2000, some of those guys had been around and done Ripper stories. I want to read a couple of bits from your book, which really helped to educate what women must have felt like about the reporting of the Ripper.
Can I just say, I'm pretty sure this is going to resonate exactly with where we are in 2024 as well still.
Right, yeah, for sure. Yeah, I'm sure you, yeah. This is Miv speaking. I had felt her death like she was someone I knew. Perhaps this was because of her age. She was young enough to still be called a girl by the men on television, and not so many years older than me. Perhaps it was because of the way she was described, with words like innocent and respectable. She wasn't one of those types of women, as Auntie Jean had called them. I had stared at these pictures over and over, looking from one to the other, my heart thumping so hard I could feel it in my ears. Now, how were you at the time? I'm not talking about Jenny the writer now, but Jenny the little girl, that there was a distinction that almost some of these women were asking to be murdered because they were maybe working as sex workers.
So I didn't understand what the distinction was, but I knew there was a distinction. There is a scene very early in the novel, and it's one of the only scenes that is direct from real life, which is where Miv's watching the television with her family, and the policeman uses the word prostitute, which was the word used then. And Miv immediately thinks, that's a word I've not heard before. What's a prostitute? And her dad says it's someone who helps the police. Now that actually happened. So I really remember watching on the black and white television another Ripper murder being reported and the word prostitute being used and me asking what it meant. And I knew the Ripper killed prostitutes. I just had no idea what that meant and why they were different, but I knew it meant that he wasn't after me. And it wasn't until the murder I write about in the book, which was Josephine Whittaker, that people started to think, hold on a second here, we're all at risk. And what's funny about that passage you just read is at the time I was writing it, and particularly those scenes, Sarah Everard had been murdered because it was 2020 or 2021. And women were sharing their experiences on social media. And I was landed back in that place of feeling someone's murder like it was someone I knew. So you're right. It does resonate now, Natalie.
Yeah. And also, I think also the fact that, you know, there are different levels, right? Because, yes, they were deemed different from so-called respectable women. There is no difference. But also they were white. So,
yes,
you know, there are so many other murders that happen still now. And, I'm sure you're similar on social media. You see it all the time about murders of young women, that happen to not be white, and they just don't get the coverage and the attention and the same media presence. Still, it's just, yeah, makes my blood boil, and I don't know how we can change it and make that right. It's really upsetting. But I also really like how you sort of Trojan horse quite a lot of these thoughts and social commentary throughout the book as well. The one that I really, or I say like, but I can kind of feel the palpable anger, I think, in this phrase, which comes quite late on, but I don't think it's a spoiler, where you've got a group of women talking about the murders, and they say, "I'm not letting them win." "Them," said Valerie. "I," the voice carried on, "men. It should be bloody men who shouldn't be out after dark, not women. We're not the bloody murderers." I'm like, yes, thank you, Jenny Godfrey. It's like, it's so ridiculous that that's still the sentiment. Like, women, like, you know, wear something that's not going to entice men, and make sure that you have a buddy if you go walking, or just stay home. It's like, we're not the issue here.
Yeah, totally. And that was direct from the Sarah Everard experience of people saying that she shouldn't have been out because it was lockdown, and me being furious about that. Yeah.
Well, better than that was the official police guidance, which came all the way from the top of the Met, which said if you're stopped by a solitary police officer, flag a bus down.
Exactly.
That was the police guidance, yeah. About their own.
Yeah. That wasn't in the 1970s. Yes.
Yeah.
Astonishing.
That was yesterday.
Yeah.
Can we just talk a bit, because I'm aware that we could obviously talk to you all day and we are not able to, that Phil alluded to the different points of view that you have in this story, which
yes.
was great. And one of those points of view is Omar, who runs the corner shop, who is a beautiful character. But again, it's something that I am really interested in, how you achieved that, to my reading of it, so well, because, you know, again, I'm a white woman. In my own writing, I want to create a diverse culture in there, but I'm also really conscious of not speaking for other people that is not my lived experience, and doing that justice. How did you get that tone and balance right for Omar?
So I was terrified of writing all the points of view, but particularly Omar's. I really was, genuinely, really. In fact, I didn't really have the confidence to do it. My agent now said, do it. And I protested or said, oh, I don't know if I could. And she basically said to me, look, I've got the confidence in you. I'll have the confidence for you. And if it's terrible, I'll tell you. And with her sort of permission, if you like, or her belief in me, I decided that I'd give it a go and that we'd take it out if it didn't work. And that is probably the area. People ask me about all the 1970s research I did. I didn't actually do a lot. I've got one of those memories that holds on to really useless information. But for Omar's character, I worked incredibly hard to really get the tone and feel of that right. And I was really aided in that by a book by M.Y. Alarm called Made in Bradford, which was first person narratives from men of a Pakistani background who'd moved to the UK and specifically to Bradford. And that was just incredibly helpful in immersing myself in a different voice and a different cultural experience. But I also, you hear me use the word lucky a lot, but I've been so lucky. One of my editors, Ayla Ahmed, is from a Muslim background, and she helped me enormously in getting that right, the feel of that right. And I've got to say, Omar, I know you're not supposed to say this because it's like, have you got a favourite child? I do have a favourite, and it is Omar. He is the character I am most proud of. Yeah, I love him.
Oh, yeah, I love
reading
him as well.
He's the corner shop owner, and it's his son Ishtiak that I referred to before, yeah, when they were playing. That's who he is, just to kind of join some dots for you. Now you can go off and buy the book and join your own.
Yeah.
Did you want to follow on the Omar thing?
No, it's fine. I just wanted I wanted to eat his food. I love when food is written about in books.
Yes.
And yeah, his food sounded delicious.
Yeah.
I know I said at the beginning that it's not a Ripper book and that the Ripper is the spectre that kind of looms in the background of what is a beautiful community story. And I stand by that. But I did want to reflect on the fact that you took a decision at the very end of the book to remember all of the victims of the Yorkshire Ripper, and they're all listed along with the dates of their death. Why did you do that?
Out of respect. If I am going to touch on such a huge story, what I didn't want to do was make it all about him. I wanted to make it about them. And the best way I could think to honour them was to make sure that the book ended on that note with their memory rather than a memory of him.
I wonder if, I can edit this out if it's not the case, but I wonder if anybody who was directly affected by those murders has read the book or has been in touch yet.
Not yet. And I was on Look North last week. Like the pinnacle of Northern fame, by the way. My mum nearly cried when I told her I was going to be on Look North. And I wondered whether I would hear or get any feedback, but I haven't had any negative feedback yet on that aspect of the story, thankfully. But if I did, I'd hear it.
Yeah. And just on those characters as well. So we talked a little bit about Auntie Jean, and I saw on your Instagram that you are currently writing Auntie Jean's origin story, which is exciting. I know you can't say much, but are you enjoying spending time with Jean?
I am having the time of my life, and it is her origin story. So this story is set in the 50s. And just getting to know her even more deeply and understanding where she comes from. I mean, I have cried already at the story. So I'm really hoping that readers who love Auntie Jean will have an experience of really loving her even more from it.
So it won't be a prequel though, will it?
No.
It just happens before this book.
Yes, yeah. So,
but... And are you going to peg it to a news event as you did with the first book?
No, it's just Auntie Jean's story.
Right.
Yeah.
And just on a kind of writerly note, is this the second book that you've written, the Auntie Jean one?
No, so the Auntie Jean origin story is a short story, which is going in an anthology, I hope. And the book two for me is proving to be, you know, you were saying, Natalie, about writing book two. It's probably the hardest thing I've ever done.
I think because you realise how long it takes and how hard it is.
And also when you've had a book that's done what The List of Suspicious Things has done, suddenly, like, I used to not really judge my writing at all on first draft. Now I feel like every placement of every sentence needs to be perfect, which makes the process really painful. I'm having to work really hard on letting go of expectation, mine more than anyone else's. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, well, so what are you thinking for your second book? Kind of just rough style.
I mean, it's definitely going to be Northern set. I'm saying that, and this will probably change, by the way, so don't hold me to it. Northern set, probably a bit darker than The List of Suspicious Things. My tastes in reading run to the dark rather than the light. But that's as sort of far as I've got. I mean, I've got many, many starts, just no finishes.
And nothing to do with this book at all, completely separate.
Oh, completely separate. I really feel strongly that The List of Suspicious Things is a standalone and they should stay there, apart from Auntie Jean's origin story.
I think it's really interesting too how, you know, we were saying at the start about how difficult it is to get local culture away in a story. I can also imagine it's probably very difficult once you've had such a success on your first book, congratulations again.
Thank you so much.
But just how probably do people want to just replicate that in a second book? And actually, you probably want to do something a bit different.
I really do. So the worst thing I could do for me is repeat book one, just in slightly differently or later. I am really, again, I'm going to use the word lucky. I am really lucky in that I have an agent who doesn't want me to replicate List of Suspicious Things at all. In fact, in her mind, whatever I do next will probably be so completely different that it will take everyone by surprise, so that I am allowed to grow as a writer. I mean, you couldn't ask for a better agent response than that, to be honest.
Absolutely. Just before we wrap things up and get your recommendations, I did want to mention, if people have read this book, if they're coming to this book, you do have this beautiful friendship at the heart of it between the two young girls, Sharon and Miv. And there is a real life Sharon, right? Who you recently reconnected with.
Yes. Oh my God. So when I first wrote the book, I did not call Miv's best friend Sharon, because I used to walk to school with a girl called Sharon and I thought it would be weird. Basically, what happened is people kept calling Miv's friend Sharon, which I think is really weird, by the way. To the extent that I kind of said to my agent at one point, why do you keep calling her Sharon? And she said, because in my mind, she is called Sharon and I can't tell you why, which I just thought was really weird. Anyway, so I changed her name to Sharon because it's a very appropriate 1970s name. And I thought, well, I better tell Sharon that this is happening so that she doesn't kind of freak out, think it's her, whatever. So I contacted her on Instagram, told her about the book, said the character's name was Sharon. I said, look, I'll send you a copy when it's ready so you can have a read. And she read it and she loved it. And just this weekend gone, I was in Yorkshire doing events and she and I met up for breakfast, like for the first time in 42 years since we've seen each other. The last time I saw her, I was waving goodbye as my family moved down south at age 11. So it was incredible.
So had you always kept in touch but just not met up, or did you lose touch?
We lost touch for a really long time. Social media is what kind of brought us back into contact with each other. And it was amazing. I mean, it was just brilliant. She had so many fantastic memories and photographs of our past. And we just totally bonded. So it was lovely to have her back in my life.
Love that story.
It's amazing.
It's beautiful. It's really beautiful. So, so you've not just had a big hit book on your hands, but you've also, it's allowed you to rekindle a friendship.
Yeah.
What a life-changing event then, given that you were 49 and just pressed the fuck it button and all of a sudden you've got your school friend back, a hit on your hands. Do you know what I mean? It's completely
life-changing. It's unrecognizable. It's really astonishing. And I am very, very, I'll use the word again, lucky.
What's the best thing that's changed and what's been the thing that has blindsided you a bit that you've had to try and cope with?
The best thing that's changed is my working life being a creative endeavour. Like I, if I'm in the zone, time just passes and that's just the best feeling. Like looking at how a character is growing and forming. Oh, just love all of that. That's the best bit. The bit that I've been a bit blindsided by is all the attention. I'm really not used to being on television and podcasts and having people like at literature festivals. I've had people come up to me and want to say about having read the book, and I'm kind of, oh wow, you recognize me, that's really weird. That takes a little bit of getting used to. Yeah,
I can imagine. Oh well, honestly, I'm so pleased for you and it's so well deserved.
Thank you.
Tell us some other books, some other stories that we can share and spread this joy of reading.
So there are two books that I wanted to recommend. The first one I've been recommending since I read it, and I feel like I'm repeating myself, but I cannot get it out of my head. It is the best thriller I have read in such a long time, possibly ever. And it's called Night Watching by Tracy Sierra.
Not read, now want to read.
My bookseller pitch would be, it's a man stalking a woman in her own house, or is it? That's my bookseller pitch.
Wow, okay.
It is a masterclass in suspense. It is not gratuitous. It is not violent. My heart was in my mouth. I didn't sleep for three nights. So that is Night Watching by Tracy Sierra.
They're not going to put that on the cover, are they? I didn't sleep for three nights, Jenny Godfrey.
And then the other one I've not long listened to. I actually listened to the audio of this. So beautiful. I cried a lot. It's Morris and Marilyn by Sophie Elmhurst. Now, it's actually narrative nonfiction, but it reads like a novel. And it's basically about a couple who was shipwrecked in the 1970s by a whale and what happened to them and their marriage. It is profoundly moving.
Wow.
Wow.
That's my two.
Haven't heard of either of those, have you?
No. Yeah, and I'm intrigued by both of them.
And they both sound great, yes.
Yeah.
Same.
Good.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah, really good.
Jenny, we can't thank you enough. I know that we both really, really enjoyed it, and we've really enjoyed your book. Yeah. And all good things coming to you are richly deserved for A, the quality of the book, but B, the balls on you to completely upend your life at 49. Fair play to you for doing that.
Thank
Don't you think that?
Inspirational, I'd say.
Yeah, 100%. Oh, thank you 100%,
both. 100%. It's been an absolute joy chatting to you. Really enjoyed it.
So the one thing that I didn't ask Jenny, I mean, there's always loads. I don't know what you're like. Whenever I do an interview for this or for anything, to be honest, in my day job as well, there are always like so many other questions I could have asked if given enough time. But, you know, people have lives and we have to stop.
I always think over-prepare and then only select your arrows if you need them.
Always. But what
you
I was going
to show off all your prep, do you?
No, exactly. But I was going to ask that kind of quite standard question that we do a fair amount on this podcast, but I'm obviously very interested in it, was whether there was TV or film interest already in the list of suspicious things. And, you know, it's one of those things where if there is, we'd know about it because there'd be an announcement, there'd be a press release that telling
not necessarily. Some writers tell us they've been optioned, but then they don't. Yeah, they wouldn't publicise the thing being optioned, would they?
But I imagine that this will hopefully be made somewhere. I think on TV rather than film.
I think TV as well. Isn't that really interesting you should say that? Because in my head, I was thinking Netflix 10 parts. Needs a big budget. They need to properly recreate Yorkshire at that time. I know that historical stuff is expensive, isn't it, because of props and what have you.
Yeah, or ITV 3 parts, I was thinking.
Were you really? Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Over a bank holiday weekend.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, let's manifest it for Jenny. I'm sure hopefully it's already in the works anyway. But yeah, it's so immersive, her writing, and so evokes that era. So whether you know it or not, and I love that we got to ask her about, you know, that this is genuinely spanning generations of readers. So young people are coming to the book and just, historical fiction, obviously, what?
I know. For two people about to turn 50 this year, that does turn the stomach a bit.
Yeah.
We now become hit relics, Nat.
Yeah, exactly.
Kids are studying us in school.
Yeah, but it's great.
I like, the thing I think she does best, the trick she pulls off, which is a really hard trick to pull off, I think, is to move the story forward. She propels the story whilst giving you a nugget. Like those passages I read out, you know, two or three sentences and she's nailed an entire character. So hard to do that, isn't it?
Yeah, but you just feel it's quite a natural skill of hers. And there was, I can't remember if it was in her acknowledgements, I think it might have been, where she was saying, and I'm going to misremember who it was attributed to, but was saying about how actually, if you've read for a lifetime, you sort of absorb that by osmosis and you can become a writer. So I almost feel like all this has been percolating in Jenny's life anyway. And now she has delivered this beautiful story, which is great. And I also really like that after we stop recording, you know, social media does get such a bad reputation, rightly so, for many things. But one of the good things it does is that book Twitter can be a beautiful place where writers and wannabe writers and fledgling writers do follow each other and just get to learn a bit more about the craft of writing. And I've done that a lot on Twitter, and there's a lovely person who I'm yet to meet called Asha Hick, who is a friend of Jenny's that I know from book Twitter. And I just got to mention that after we stopped recording. And so just in case Asha is listening, hi Asha, hope to meet you at some point.
Big up Asha. Asha's mentioning the acknowledgements as well. I was just checking when you were referring back to them there. I tell you who else is mentioning the acknowledgements is Guardian journalist Phil Doust. Do you know that name?
I don't.
He's mentioned favourably by Jenny, right? But he ruffled the feathers of Tim Minchin. And if you have a Google after this, on probably on YouTube, actually, the Phil Doust song, he wrote an entire song about it because Phil Doust gave him a 2-star, 1-star review at Edinburgh. And the rhyming couplet goes, something, something Phil Doust, Guardian journal loused. but yeah, it's quite, I spoke to Tim Minchin about that and he kind of regrets writing that. It's quite vicious. Mm. It was literally, it's a swipe back at a bad review, basically.
Yeah.
Which I'm sure we all feel like doing, but I'm not sure if like a year down the track, it's then a good idea. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's that instant heated reaction, isn't it?
Yeah. Tim Minchin seems a good guy.
Yeah, he is. Yeah, he is. A lot of fun to interview. Well, excellent. I think, are we going to take a break?
Briefly, yeah. To kind of make sure that we can, because the whole point about doing this podcast is that we want to find books that we generally want to read as well that we can then share with you. Yeah. So we need a little bit of time every so often to actually be able to read them.
Yeah, and also some that won't make it onto the podcast. You know, as we record on the 26th of March, I'm awaiting my delivery of the 50th anniversary edition of Carrie.
Mm.
Now, the chances of Stephen King coming on this are quite remote. I don't think he does any interviews at all. Does he?
Yeah.
But they tend to be Zoom things with other writers, don't they? You don't see him on chat shows and you don't see him.
I saw him on CBS Mornings recently.
Oh, did you? Okay, interesting. All right. Do you know anybody at CBS Mornings that can put a word in for us?
But that's fine.
But I want to read that. I didn't read that when that came out in 1974 because that was the year I was born. Mm-hmm. So I'm as old as that book. And so I'd like to read that. And what else? I'm just finishing off the latest Richard Osman, which I've loved. The Thursday Murder, absolutely loved, and the strongest of the three in my view. Mm-hmm. Really enjoyed that. I've got about 40 pages left. And there was one more that I thought I wanted to tuck into before we get back to books that might be on the podcast. And I can't for the life of me remember what it is because I'm old.
That's all right. We'll tell people about it. And also, do we want to say about a website?
Yeah.
So if you have got to this stage of the podcast, yes, we might be taking a brief break. And by a break, I say maybe like a month, but there are loads of episodes you can dip into and we'll keep putting out loads of stuff on social media. So do follow us on social media. I'm Natalie Jameson, all one word, on Instagram, or at Nat_Jameson on Twitter.
Twitter, I'm at Phil Williams, not the one in America that keeps winning awards. I keep getting his tweets for. And on Insta, I am at Phil Radio Williams. Well, I should probably change that at some point.
But if you, as a little gift that's been a long time gestating, there is finally a bestsellers podcast website, right?
Yeah. By the time you hear this, yeah, it should be live. It's in trial mode at the moment where we said to a few friends, what do you think of this? And they all love the look of it so far. But Mrs. W spotted about 20 snagging errors. Like, imagine it's a new build house. Be things like, you know, the handle isn't quite screwed on the right way, that kind of thing. So I just need to go through those and correct those minor tweaks. And then by the time you hear this, hopefully it'll be live and it will be factually correct and all the links will work. And the thing about the website, what we've wanted to do is build something where all the episodes live and all the author recommendations live. And certainly when it goes live, you will have all of the current season 5, all of season 5's author recommendations. So like you just heard Jenny's 2 books at the end of that. We'll have every writer that's been on season 5. You'll have all of their recommendations in the author recommendations section on the website. And you click it, you'll find the books will carousel in front of your very eyes. And then if you fancy one of them, you can click a buy button and it will take you straight to a link to buy that book. So we couldn't have made it any easier for you. And that's been the dream. And we finally realized it after, I'd say, 2 months of blood, sweat and tears, wouldn't you? Because neither of us are web developers and we've done it ourselves. We do everything ourselves. I know we stress that to you, but I think people go, yeah, you say that, but you've probably got someone to edit it. No, Natalie will edit this edition. Then I will run it through a video software thing to get clips for socials. And Natalie will update the website. Natalie's done all the author recommendations. I've done all the back episodes. So every episode from season 1 to 5 is up and available for you. And it takes time to learn how to do that shit and a few swear words. And then it's there.
Yeah. So we hope you enjoy. And yeah, happy reading. Share with us what you're reading. Tell your friends about the podcast. And we'll be back very soon.